Cardona with your health tip of the day from the African American Wellness Project.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll discuss a lawsuit that has special meaning this week that we honor Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
We'll speak with civil rights attorney Flint Taylor about new evidence alleging FBI and NYPD involvement in the assassination of Malcolm X.
We speak with Professor Emeritus from Purdue University, Bill Mullen, on Black resistance to fascism. Bill's written two books, We Charge Genocide, American Fascism and the Rule of Law, and The Black Anti-Fascist Tradition, Fighting Back from Anti-Lynching to Abolition. What Bill has to say is profound. We can't rely on anything but ourselves in the streets, demonstrating from day one.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer. A groundbreaking legal case seeks justice for the family of one of our country's most iconic civil rights leaders, Malcolm X. In an unprecedented lawsuit filed by his daughters, the Shabazz family is challenging the U.S. government, the city of New York, and several high-ranking law enforcement agencies. At the heart of the case is the claim that state actors, including the FBI and NYPD, played an active role in the assassination of Malcolm X on February 22, 1965, and that this involvement has been systematically covered up for decades. This suit, Malcolm X Shabazz et al. Versus USA, not only seeks justice for the wrongful death of Malcolm X, but also aims to hold the government accountable for its complicity in the assassination. The case draws on newly uncovered evidence linking federal agencies to the events surrounding Malcolm X's death, as well as for framing and wrongfully convicting two men who were only recently exonerated in 2021. The legal team behind this case includes civil rights attorneys Benjamin Crump and G. Flint Taylor. If successful, their argument could rewrite the historical narrative surrounding one of our country's tragic and significant moments. At the core of this case is the question, how deep was the state's involvement in silencing Malcolm X? How coordinated was the campaign to prevent the rise of Black leaders? And what has been the scope of the government's role in suppressing movements for racial justice and civil rights, both in the past and in the present day? We're joined by attorney Flint Taylor of the People's Law Office in Chicago. Flint represented the family of Fred Hampton and revealed that the FBI and Chicago Police Department murdered him in 1969. Flint is an editor of the Police Misconduct Law Reporter and is the author of Torture Machine, Racism and Police Violence in Chicago. Flint Taylor, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Maria. It's really nice to be with you and Heidi again, and I'm looking forward to discussing this very important topic.
Well, why don't you start by telling us a little more about the lawsuit filed by the Shabazz family? What are its main objectives, and what are the key claims made against the government and law enforcement agencies?
Well, as you know, it's almost 60 years since the assassination of Malcolm X, and a tremendous amount of evidence, so to speak, has come out over the years, but particularly important evidence came out approximately 3 years ago in the case of the two men who were exonerated for being wrongfully convicted for the assassination of Malcolm X. So that gave us the ability and the foundation to bring this case on behalf of Malcolm's sisters and on behalf of his estate. And of course, it is a 1983, a civil rights case brought under the Anti-Ku Klux Klan Act of 1871, and it seeks damages for the family members, and it has about nine different counts in it, and it has various claims, including two important claims that are based on the suppression of evidence by the FBI and the New York Police Department and its Bossie unit, the Red Squad unit of the NYPD, and those claims being denial of access to the courts, effective ability to bring a case over all these years, and also fraudulent concealment under New York law. So those are the predicates for our being back in court at this point. And of course, there are other claims of conspiracy under the Civil Rights Act, claims of wrongful death, and claims of other kinds of violations of the Constitution.
Flint, are you able to share the details of new evidence that surfaced in recent years suggesting state complicity in the assassination? And how does this new information impact the case?
Well, in November of 2021, when the two men were exonerated with the behind the work of the Innocence Project and the prosecutor, Cyrus Vance, they made reference to new evidence that implicated the FBI in a widespread cover-up of information that was relevant to the assassination, as well as evidence that further implicated the Bossie unit of the New York Police Department in the conspiracy, not only to facilitate the assassination of Malcolm X, to permit it to happen, knowing that it would, in all likelihood, but also in a vast cover-up, which, as I mentioned, prevented, among other things, not only the public from knowing the true scope of the government and police involvement in the assassination, but, legally speaking, prevented the family and the estate from effectively seeking justice in the courts, access to the courts. And some of that evidence included revelation that there were numerous FBI informants in the ballroom at the time that Malcolm X was assassinated, and that J. Edgar Hoover, together with Bossie, made sure that none of those informants were revealed, nor could they be witnesses to what actually went on in the ballroom. So that was a very important piece of evidence that was revealed for the first time in 2021. Another extremely important piece of evidence was that the other shooter, the man Bradley, who wielded the shotgun that assassinated Malcolm X, that he had not only an FBI file, but he had mysterious connections to the government. He was out of the Newark Mosque where the assassination actually took place from or was planned from, and those members were the ones who were the assassins. And it showed that later on, after the events, of course he got away, he was arrested for a bank robbery. And he had a co-defendant, and all of a sudden, he passed a note to the judge, and he ended up, I believe, getting probation for a federal bank robbery, while his co-defendant ended up getting 25 years. So that raises very serious questions about what his connection to the government was, not only at that time, whether he had been getting some kind of hush money, or that was a payoff for his keeping silent, or in fact whether he was an FBI informant at the time that he wielded the shotgun that killed Malcolm X. There's also some evidence, some reports and other information having to do, one report called the Blackwell Report, which had to do with the New York Police Department, which was evidence that was concealed that also was very material to the question of the NYPD's involvement, not only in the cover-up, but as well in knowledge of and participation in the assassination, because the NYPD as well had informants, including a man named Roberts, who was actually on the stage at the time that Malcolm was assassinated, and another undercover agent named Ray Wood, who was involved in the what they call the Statute of Liberty case. And in fact, he was an undercover agent that set up several of Malcolm's security detail to be arrested for a bogus Statute of Liberty conspiracy only days before the assassination of Malcolm. So there's evidence that had been suppressed, and no doubt a lot more evidence that's still unknown that hopefully we will be able to uncover during this lawsuit.
Flint Taylor, Malcolm X was murdered 60 years ago as of February 22nd. What made your team decide to take this case now? What makes it so significant, even decades after his death?
Well, it's always been significant. It has always been a question of government involvement. The reason I got involved, Ben Crump asked me to get involved, and also there are some terrific New York civil rights lawyers, Lawyers Guild lawyers, including Jonathan Moore, who is very well known because of the Exonerated Five, the Central Park Five case, also the Stop and Frisk cases that he was involved in, and the Eric Garner case. So we feel we've got a very, very strong legal team that's steeped in decades and decades of struggle against governments to show government conspiracy. And as you mentioned, I was involved for 13 years in the case of the assassination of Fred Hampton and Mark Clark, the Black Panther leaders here in Chicago. And during that case, we were able to uncover COINTELPRO, COINTELPRO being a secret government program headed up by and masterminded by J. Edgar Hoover, the former longtime FBI director. And that COINTELPRO program was not only designed to destroy the Black Panther Party ultimately, but also by its own definition and documents was designed to neutralize and disrupt Black militant organizations. And to quote the document in 1968, to prevent the rise of a messiah who could unify and electrify the Black nationalist movement. And in their documents, they cited Dr. King, they cited Stokely Carmichael, and they cited Malcolm X, who, of course, by that time had been assassinated 4 years before the document was actually circulated. So there's always been a question about what does that naming of Malcolm X, what does the COINTELPRO program that was designed to disrupt the Nation of Islam when Malcolm was a leader there, and ultimately when he started his own organization a year before he was assassinated, when he was becoming much more internationalist in his views and less black, quote, black nationalist, end quote. So all of those questions have been left kind of out there. In the Hampton case, we were able to show through FBI documents that the FBI actually was involved in planning and covering up the assassination under the COINTELPRO program. There are, and certainly now that there's more evidence of FBI complicity that's come out, as I said, in the prosecution or the dismissal of the prosecution of the exonerated men, there's even more questions about exactly what was the government's role under COINTELPRO. Who were those informants? Were they provocateurs? What exactly did they know and what exactly did they do? Was Bradley one of the, actually an FBI informant at the time that he led the assassination of Malcolm X? Those are all questions that have and continue to be extremely important, not only to history, but to, in fact, the understanding of the depth of what a government will do to silence important leaders of color. Of course, the CIA's involvement is also a question in this case.
Well, Flint, because of that, the lawsuit does name several agencies and individuals, including, of course, J. Edgar Hoover. Can you talk just a little more about the role these people and agencies played, especially in the aftermath, the cover-up of the assassination?
Yes, as I mentioned earlier, there were kept secret the fact that there were at least 9 FBI informants that were in the ballroom at the time. Also kept silent was the fact that Bradley was not only known to the FBI and had a file in the FBI offices, but that in fact, as I mentioned, the role that the government may have played in him basically walking free in an armed federal bank robbery. So that is some of the evidence we need to see and that has come out recently. And also the cooperation between the FBI and Bossie and the New York Police Department and to some degree the prosecutor at that time, the prosecutor's office, in covering it up. The fact of the 9 informants was kept from Bossie, or it may well be that Bossie and the New York Police Department knew about these informants, and so it was a cooperative effort to cover up that evidence. And without going into too much detail, the way that the, quote, witnesses, end quote, that the New York Police Department, its detective division, and Bossie in the aftermath, witnesses that they used to falsely and wrongfully convict the 2 men was also and is also another aspect of why their cases were ultimately thrown out some 56, 57 years later. And of course, also impact very strongly on the questions that are raised by our lawsuit.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm Maria Hall here with my co-host Heidi Bogosian. We're speaking with attorney Flint Taylor about a new lawsuit brought by the family of Malcolm X to achieve justice for his murder. Well, Flint Taylor, in 2021, 2 men who were wrongfully convicted of murdering Malcolm X were exonerated. How does their exoneration factor into the current lawsuit?
Well, of course, it's very important. Our case is different in the sense that there was no exoneration, there was assassination. So in some ways that makes it a different legal case than the cases for the men that were wrongfully convicted. But on the other hand, the body of evidence that has been concealed and the implications and inferences that can be drawn and the evidence that is still to be uncovered parallels in many ways those cases. And I would point out that in the Aziz case, the police department settled that case for $27 million, and the case against the federal government is still pending. And in that case, they are seeking some of the same evidence that I have been talking about. So there is already a body of evidence that the Shabazz family and the estate and we have not yet seen that has been unearthed not only during the exoneration, but also in the civil suits that have been brought for Mr. Aziz, one of the 2 wrongfully convicted men. I would say that this case is not only a civil rights case under the Anti-Ku Klux Klan Act, but it is a case, a human rights case. It is a case of international significance because, as history tells us, Malcolm had left the Nation of Islam, started his own organization, and had traveled to Mecca and had traveled through Africa and was making the kind of international contacts in the last year of his life that not only was problematic, shall we say, to the U.S. government, but particularly to the CIA. And also, because of the fact that it's a human rights case, it is also a case not only for damages, but when you think about it, it's a case for reparations. It's a case for reparations to Malcolm's family that should have been made and still can be made regardless of a lawsuit. There are parallels to a case that I was fortunate enough to work on here in Chicago, reparations for victims of police torture, where the city of Chicago, because of the movements that demanded it in 2015, gave reparations to some 60 survivors of police torture who did not have a legal case, but they had the fact that they were tortured many years before by this notorious torturer, John Burge. And the reparations were not only financial reparations, but they were also reparations that included teaching the truth about torture to 8th and 10th grade students in the Chicago public schools, the creation of a center on the south side of Chicago to treat and for torture survivors and other victims of police violence, and other very unique and groundbreaking reparations. The city of New York particularly needs to look at the Malcolm X case and the evidence of its involvement as it continues to evolve, and to determine not only how they're going to deal with the lawsuit as a lawsuit, but how they're going to deal with the demand that it be dealt with as a human rights case and dealt with as a question of reparations, not only to the family, but reparations in the sense of history, in the sense of conceding and, in fact, embracing the truth about what prior governments, prior police departments within the city of New York, what they did and human rights violations that it contemplates.
Well, Flint, in that same vein, Benjamin Crump has spoken of the difficulties in seeking justice for cases involving historic wrongs. What are the challenges in pursuing a case against the FBI and the NYPD, especially during the Trump administration?
Well, Ben is right. These are always uphill battles. And I mentioned it took 13 years of litigation in the Fred Hampton case to ultimately uncover the parameters of the conspiracy, to ultimately reach a settlement for the families of Fred Hampton and Mark Clark and the survivors of the police raid. So he and I and John Moore and all of our team from our law firms, we go in with our eyes open about how difficult this may be. On the other hand, when you have such righteousness on your side, that often can prevail. And ultimately, at some point, it will prevail, even if the lawsuit itself is not successful, because to deal with the historical implications and to put them in the context of the government complicity is an important task that we have taken on, and we'll continue to fight it, and so will his family and who is lined up and giving us the strength and inspiration to continue to fight this case. And yes, the Trump administration, we can spend hours talking about the implications of what he and his people are all about. Nixon came before him. Reagan came before him. Bush came before him, the two Bushes. The government has never been sympathetic to admitting what, in fact, their law enforcement agencies have done in their name. So that's nothing new. But we do have a mayor in New York under siege, as he is, in terms of allegations of corruption, who, in fact, can do a righteous thing here. He could do something that the people of New York, I'm sure, would support, and his city council hopefully would support, and that is to actually admit to the wrongdoing that implicates the New York Police Department and make right by the family, as they actually did with regard to the exonerated men. We're hopeful that that will happen with regard to New York City and the mayor and the mechanisms that run that city. that they will see the light now that this lawsuit has been filed, and make reparations, not only financial, but other historical reparations.
Flint Taylor, how do the tactics used against Malcolm X and other civil rights leaders in the 1960s compare to our current state surveillance and actions against contemporary movements like Black Lives Matter?
Well, that's an important question, and that's somewhat of a difficult question to answer, in the sense that tactics evolve. You don't see the same kinds of assassination attempts, at least we haven't recently, that were fomented in the 60s with Malcolm and Fred Hampton. But the kinds of surveillance with all the way up to artificial intelligence that we have today really makes it really, really scary in terms of the capabilities that a government and an FBI in the hands of the kinds of people that Trump is trying to get appointed, what that portends for the future. And of course, we've seen over the decades since the assassination of Fred Hampton and Malcolm X, similar COINTELPRO type attacks on the American Indian movement, for example, on the Puerto Rican independence movement, and more recently, as you mentioned, the Black Lives Matter movement, the folks that organized at Standing Rock and who are fighting against pipelines across the Midwest to this day. There's so many other movements that we look at what Cop City in Atlanta, and actually that was a killing of a young activist. So those kinds of things keep reoccurring. The fundamental white supremacy and racism that is so much part and parcel of these attacks by the government and the state agencies working hand in hand with them certainly has not gone away, and it is on the rise again and being publicly fomented by the Trump and his people. All of those things which we saw in the 60s in different form to some degree, but nonetheless in as violent and illegal and unconstitutional manner, we're seeing again today. And so, on the other hand, we have a lot of wonderful young folks who are fighting against this and who are fighting basically for all of our lives and in terms of everything from water, say in environmental issues, to issues that Black Lives Matter and the movement for Black Lives is fighting for. So I guess that's a long way of saying the more things change, the more they stay the same. But in that sense, they not only stay the same, but they are being, technology makes them even more frightening in many ways.
Flint, it's really been our honor to talk to you, especially as we celebrate Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day. How can our listeners follow both your work and that of the People's Law Office?
Well, People's Law Office has a website, and we continue to try to do some of the same work that we're dedicated to in 1969 when we were founded, and working with the Black Panthers and the Young Lords and all of those folks. Personally, I have a book called The Torture Machine, which documents not only the Fred Hampton case, but 35 or 40 years that myself and my office has been involved in the struggle to expose the torture ring here in Chicago that lasted for over 20 years. Personally, again, I have another book that's going to come out soon called Prosecutors, Politicians, Police Violence, A Chicago Story. And it's about the Hampton case and all of the prosecutors, particularly Ed Hanrahan, that was along with the federal government behind the assassinations. And it's about the one particular police torture case and all the prosecutorial corruption in that case that spanned over 30 years and continues. And it's called, it's the Jackie Wilson case. So that's a little bit of both my work and, of course, the People's Law Office work, which continues to be fighting these struggles. And we hopefully will be for another 50 years.
Well, we look forward to reading your forthcoming book and to having you back on Law and Disorder, as we are all huge fans, Flint. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. And I'm a huge fan of this show. And keep up the great work. And shout out to Mike Smith, who, of course, is one of your co-hosts. And he's a tremendous friend, and as you are and all are, in terms of fighting movement issues and educating everyone as to what the real deal is.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
National chauvinism and racism are essential features of fascism. The practice of white racism in the United States during the Jim Crow era was something that Hitler's fascist party in Germany studied and emulated. This kind of anti-black racism went on in the United States from shortly after the Civil War up until the 1960s. And indeed, it's never really gone away, as the mass mobilizations of the Black Lives Matter movement recently demonstrated. This black resistance, this fight back, will be a central aspect of anti-fascist activity in the future. Here to speak with us today is Professor Bill Mullen, the co-author of The Black Anti-Fascist Tradition, Fighting Back from Anti-Lynching to Abolition, and his new book, published last month, We Charge Genocide, American Fascism and the Rule of Law. Bill Mullen is a professor emeritus of American Studies at Purdue University and the co-founder of the Campus Anti-Fascist Network. Professor Bill Mullen, a hearty welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Bill, the great Jewish-Italian writer Primo Levi, who himself spent time in an Italian fascist prison camp when Mussolini was the dictator in Italy in the 30s, has observed that there are many kinds of fascism. Has fascism historically existed in this country? And if so, in what ways, both historically and currently?
Well, we've never had a full-blown fascist state in the United States, but we've had a regular stream of fascist movements. During the period of classical fascism that you reference in the 1930s, there were groups like the Black Legion, which were very sympathetic, that formed in the United States, that were very sympathetic to European fascism. There was a group called the German-American Bund, which was basically incentivized by the rise of fascism in Germany. And they famously had a giant rally with 20,000 people at Madison Square Garden in 1939, which is a moment that most of us have forgotten about. I mean, if you fast forward to the late 50s, in 1959, you had the American Nazi Party was formed by a guy named George Lincoln Rockwell. Was a kind of a street level force in the 1960s, you know, attacking civil rights protesters and the like. And in our time, you know, the landscape is kind of littered with neo-Nazi and white supremacist groups that come and go. Groups like the Traditionalist Workers Party, which was actually founded by a guy named Matthew Heimbach. There's the Patriot Front. There's the Proud Boys, which of course Donald Trump made famous by genuflecting to a couple years ago. And there are others. All of them are kind of unified usually by, you know, a form of authoritarian white supremacy, misogyny, and anti-democratic politics, you know, combined with street-level fighting forces. So we've never not, since the 1930s, had some fascist current or movement alive in the United States.
Bill, in your book, which you co-authored with Janelle Hope, called The Black Anti-Fascist Tradition, Fighting Back from Anti-Lynching to Abolition, you write about quite a few magnificent struggles. Can you give us a brief description of the highlights of some of those struggles? For example, what did Ida B. Wells work on?
Ida B. Wells was the champion of anti-lynching. She wrote a book called The Red Record, which was a chronicle in 1895 of the huge numbers of lynchings that had taken place in the United States across the South, especially since the end of the Civil War. She had her own newspaper dedicated primarily to trying to abolish lynching. And we talk about her as what we call a premature anti-fascist, because she understood the relationship between racial violence, racial terrorism, and the role of the state. And in fact, in 1917, 1918, 1919, in her own newspaper, in addition to writing about lynching, she was pointing to the parallels between lynchings in America and the pogroms, you know, taking place in Europe against Jews. Now, this was well before the rise of formal fascism, but we argue in the book that she's a great example of how black radicals, especially, who've been always attuned to things like racial violence, oftentimes anticipated fascism before other groups. W.A.B. Du Bois, in 1915, when he was writing about, you know, World War I, talked about the kinds of techniques being used in the colonies as what he later understood to be like templates for the rise of fascism. Du Bois actually went to Germany in 1934 because he was aware that of what was happening to the Jews. Wells is a great example in our book of a tradition that begins in the early 20th century of black anti-fascism. We talk about the Black Panther Party, which in the late 1960s, you know, organized a huge United Front Against Fascism conference in Oakland, which drew about 5,000 people and was really committed to trying to theorize the potentiality of a fascist state emerging in the United States, primarily because of its use of mass incarceration and police violence. So those are kind of two ends of the spectrum, and in between we talk about some other movements as well.
In your new book titled We Charge Genocide, American Fascism and the Rule of Law, you write about the petition a number of lawyers brought in 1950. Please put this petition in context for us. Where was it brought? Who wrote it? And what did it charge specifically?
Sure. The petition was called We Charge Genocide. It was authored by a group called the Civil Rights Congress. The Civil Rights Congress had emerged out of the Communist Party's work in the United States in the 1940s. Its leader was a black attorney named William Patterson. It had other participants in the petition campaign, included W.E.B. Du Bois, who I talked about earlier, and Paul Robeson, the singer and activist. The petition was drafted originally in 1948, and it used the United Nations' new definition of genocide, which was part of its Convention on Human Rights, and applied it to black life in the United States. And what they did was chronicle the long histories of slavery, colonialism, police violence, lynchings, to argue that the Genocide Convention and its definition should actually be applied to the long history of anti-black violence in the United States. They brought it to the United Nations in 1951, formally submitted it, were hoping that it would be deliberated on the floor of the UN. That never happened because the US State Department used all of its power to make sure that the petition never reached the floor, was never actually formally voted on. Eleanor Roosevelt actually played a very large role in suppressing it. And the intention was to bring international attention to the plight of black folks and to draw analogies between the recent Holocaust in Europe and what they understood to be the sort of the slow genocide that black people had been subjected to from the earliest days of America's, you know, settler colonial state. It's a real extraordinary document. It's still available as a book from international publishers that gets reprinted regularly. And it's very relevant to our time as we're, you know, reviewing things like the International Court of Justice bringing genocide charges against the State of Israel for the war in Gaza. I highly recommend folks go back and take a look at the way that these attorneys framed in 1951 charges of genocide against the U.S. state.
We're speaking with Professor Bill Mullen on his two books on American fascism and black resistance. Bill, who are the people you're trying to reach with your book, We Charge Genocide? At whom was it aimed? What do you want readers to come away learning from it?
Well, I wrote this book because, you know, there's been a lot of attention being paid to the rise of fascism globally in the last 10 or 15 years, not just in the United States, but in places like Poland and Brazil and the Philippines. We're obviously living in a reign of a new authoritarianism. And I wanted to look at the role that the law had played in the not only the rise of fascism, but the implementation of fascism. One of the myths of American democracy is that, you know, the rule of law will save us from things like dictatorship. But in fact, German fascism and Italian fascism both used the courts and the law specifically to implement fascism and fascist rule. In fact, some of that was actually borrowed from the United States. The German jurisprudence during the Nazi years borrowed heavily from American Jim Crow law, for example. So I wanted to remind people that the law is not always our friend when it comes to fighting fascism, and in fact that the law can actually be our enemy. And I was kind of motivated to this by the attention that the Black Lives Matter movement had given to the role of police in our society. And I wanted to kind of go one level past the police and look at the role of the law. Obviously, you know, the courts and the legal system empowered the cops to do the kinds of things that we've been protesting the last 10 years, you know, meaning particularly violence against Black populations and the like. So I really feel like activists and organizers need to study the law and its kind of sometimes pernicious role and include it in our menu of things that we resist when we're trying to resist the suppression of democracy. So that was one of my target audiences. And the other is, you know, scholars who have actually written about this quite a bit. James Whitman, who this brilliant law professor wrote this book called Hitler's American Model, which documents the very specific ways in which the Nazi courts used Jim Crow law to build, for example, the Nuremberg laws. And all of the codifications of anti-Semitism were directly borrowed from the American model of anti-Black legal racism in the United States. So I really feel in the time that we're living in, whether or not you think Trump is a fascist, and Trump, you notice that Trump is also very adroit at using the courts, you cannot separate the rule of law from the potentiality of fascism. They're always intertwined.
You better believe it. Bill, you believe that the U.S. legal system has contributed to the growth of fascist states and fascist movements domestically and internationally. How did it do this here in the USA?
Well, one was the example I just gave of the usage of Jim Crow laws, which, you know, after the end of Reconstruction, the rise of Ku Klux Klan terrorism and lynchings in the South was all enabled by the courts. We have to understand that Jim Crow was a legal infrastructure, and it gave rise to a long period of white supremacy. I include the Ku Klux Klan in my catalog of American fascist groups, for example. In the contemporary period, I have a chapter in my book about what's called in legal scholarship, it's called legal originalism. And it's the argument that the only laws that have valence or should be considered legitimate are those that are in the original Constitution. This is a really interesting movement that began with the Southern segregationists in the 1950s who were trying to find ways of blocking the Supreme Court's attempts, like Brown versus Board of Education, to force integration on the American South. And one of the arguments that they begin to make and carries through for really all through up until the current moment is that laws like the 14th Amendment, which gave citizenship to Black people after the end of slavery, are not legitimate laws because they're not original to the Constitution. In other words, they're add-on and amendments. Well, since the 1960s, a lot of white power and Christian identity movements have used this very same argument of legal originalism to argue that only white people are legitimate citizens of the United States. So Jews, Blacks, anybody else who wasn't included in the original constitutional definition are not what they call sovereigns. So I find this really interesting because this legal originalism was both popular during the 1980s, during the Reagan years, when people like Ed Meese, for example, were trying to bring forward and pack the courts with legal originalists as a way of diminishing the appeal, the potentiality of civil rights in the United States. And on the ground, white supremacist groups in the American Northwest began their own constitutional forums. They began to have constitutional conventions to kind of rewrite the American Constitution and write out these post constitutional amendments. So I think this is really important because white supremacy, which is baked into the Constitution, has been recaptured by illegal originalists as a founding fathers argument. And so when you hear right-wing attorneys these days invoking legal originalism, there we should also remember that there's a really pernicious thread of racist, nativist ideology that they are also invoking by invoking constitutional originalism. So that this is one way in which I think fascism and its potential remains alive through legal argument.
You're listening to Law and Disorder Radio. This is Attorney Michael Smith, your host, and I'm speaking with Professor Bill Mullen on his two books on fascism and the law and the black struggle. Bill, because of the very nature of black oppression in the USA, the resistance to it will be at the heart of any kind of anti-fascist movement here. What lessons do you draw from your understanding of the history of black resistance?
Well, one of the things Janelle and I argue in our book is that fascism always is an anti-black ideology. And we recover, for example, the writings of people like M.A. Césaire and Walter Rodney, who made the connection between colonial racism and the rise of fascism. And they essentially put Africa and the lives of black people at the center when they asked the question, where did fascism come from? M.A. Césaire famously said, fascism in Europe was simply the tactics and techniques of colonialism coming home to roost against the white population in Europe, right? So to think about the history of blackness in the Western world is to like recenter it when we think about the long trajectories that have led to fascism, not just the events of the 19-teens and the 1920s. So that's one. Secondly, we point out that I mentioned people like Ida B. Wells and Du Bois and the Civil Rights Congress, they've always understood the particular anti-black role of the police and the state and the law, and they always have understood it as an ingredient of fascism. That's why Du Bois, we write about a woman named Thyra Edwards, who was a black activist in the 1930s. They were going to Germany and writing about the rise of fascism in the early 30s, well before it was even being covered by the mainstream media in the United States, because they understood fascism directly as an attack on black life potential. Obviously, the fascism in Italy and Germany, for example, was also coded as very strongly anti-black. I mean, Mussolini, by the late 1930s, Italy had also codified blackness as a form of racial inferiority. So looking at anti-black fascism and the role of anti-blackness in fascism, we feel is really important. And it's a story that hasn't really been told, partly because there's so much attention, obviously, to Europe as a site of fascism, and also the questions of anti-Semitism. And we feel like putting anti-blackness in conversation with anti-Semitism is really, really important. These are two forms of racism that, you know, co-constitute each other historically, at least on the far right.
Let's talk about the Trump phenomena. Former Chief of Staff General Kelly said yesterday that he believed that Trump was a fascist. And he said it fit the classical definition of fascism. What is your understanding of the classical definition of fascism? And how do you appreciate the Trump phenomena?
Well, I align myself with people who describe fascism as a crisis in capitalism that is resolved by the use of extreme force, extra legality, discipline and punishment of the working class, and attacks on vulnerable populations, whoever they might be. All of those things have a long history in the United States. I see Donald Trump as the end product of American history. He simply taps into nativism, anti-black racism, misogyny, and appeals to authority and authoritarianism that have always been part of the American political landscape. He's simply a new embodiment of many of these ideas. I think what's important about Trumpism, though, too, is that it comes from below. I believe that Trumpism as a phenomenon was anticipated by the rise of white power and white supremacist groups in the 80s and the 90s. The Tea Party movement around 2008 and 9, if you remember that, was a prototype for what became Trumpism. Like many fascist-leaning people, Trump has dog-whistled and appealed directly to that base. And, you know, one way to think about whether Trump is a fascist or not, and I don't believe his first term was a fascist term, but if January 6th had happened at the beginning of his term as opposed to the end, we might be having a different conversation about whether Trump is a fascist. If he's reelected, we'll see. We'll see exactly what happens on day one. I do think, you know, Angela Davis said in 1971, fascism is a process, not necessarily a product. And clearly Trump is part of and aware of historical processes which he has exploited to enable and advance the potentiality of fascism in the United States. That's how I see it. And we'll have to see how, you know, the election plays out and what happens next.
Well, let's assume that Trump gets elected. What do we do? What can we learn from your books about what to do?
Well, I think the first thing we should do is realize that the courts are not going to save us. The lawyers are not going to save us. The cops are not going to save us. The legal apparatus is not going to save us. What we need is mass mobilization. The only way to beat fascism is to mobilize against it on the streets and to outnumber them. And you can't do that with lawyers, you know, as much as I love some lawyers. So what we really need to do is be ready to mobilize again if Trump is elected. I mean, I remember in 2017 after Charlottesville, you know, 50,000 people showed up, more or less, in Boston when the new far right was trying to organize after Charlottesville. That was a really important moment. We have to be ready to do that kind of thing again. We might have to be able to do it on election night. Trump's lawyers have already filed apparently 100 lawsuits to declare the results of the election illegitimate even before it happens. So fascism is at its core anti-democratic. Trump is at his core is anti-democratic. So I believe that we're going to need the possibilities of mass mobilization sooner rather than later after this election.
What do you think the role of the Democratic Party has been and will be?
Well, I think they're an enabler of the far right. I think they have stood by and large, while the right has grown and strengthened itself. But the Democratic Party aligning itself with the police, aligning itself with the war against Palestinians, they've made it clear that they're comfortable with racial violence and state power on their own terms. These are really things that, you know, don't distinguish them in many ways from the right wing of the United States. So I think we should put no stock in the Democratic Party as a break on the increasing move to the right in this country. Win or lose, the right is going to continue to grow and struggle in this country. And the Democratic Party the Democratic Party right now is lionizing people like Dick Cheney, who, you know, most of us remember as a war criminal from 20 years ago, who legitimated, you know, the torture of inmates at Guantanamo. So the Democratic Party has made peace with its own versions of authoritarianism and racial violence and state terrorism. They're not a friend of us when we're thinking about organizing against fascism.
Yeah, I would add to that the phenomena of Harris campaigning in Pennsylvania for fracking. And I would also add to that the phenomena of the close down of the campus encampments, which was done with the permission of the Democratic Party. So I think that with respect to the climate movement and democratic rights, we have to be very, very cautious about throwing any kind of support to them. Bill, we're almost, unfortunately, at the end of our allotted time, but I wanted to ask you, do you have any final thoughts before we have to say goodbye?
I think people should be ready to organize on election night and be prepared for the worst possible outcome. And we need to, if we're going to achieve democracy in this country, it's going to have to be won by people out on the streets and organizing from below. And that's, I think, the way it's always been. And I don't think it's going to be any different after election night. So I hope people are making preparations for that.
Thank you, Bill Mullen. Thank you very much for your fine work in this excellent interview. Bill, tell our audience how people can stay in touch with you and your work.
My book with Janelle Hope on Black Anti-Fascism is available from Haymarket Books, and my We Charge Genocide book is available from Fordham University Press, and I'm on Facebook, but I don't really do a lot of other social media. My email address is at the Purdue University website, where I'm a professor emeritus. People could reach out to me through that email if they'd like to have a conversation.
Very good. Thank you so much, Bill Mullen, for being our guest on Law and Disorder Radio. You take it easy.
Thanks, Michael.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
And I thank our listeners for joining us here today on Law and Disorder, and I urge you all to visit our website, lawanddisorder.org. There you'll learn ways to support the show and spread the message of the show, and we'll appreciate that as well.
For the One World Community Radio Program on 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, 88.7 FM WRHU, Hempstead Radio, Hofstra University, 88.1 FM WCWP, Brookville, LIU Post, 88.3 FM WRCT, Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon University, 88.3 FM WVCR, Loudonville, Siena College, 98.1 and 105.9 FM WKZE Salisbury Red Hook, and around the world at WRHU.org. This is One World Community Radio, coming up next on your favorite community radio station.
Program, a collaboration between 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, and 88.7 FM WRHU Radio, Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York. Broadcasting from the Bush Radio Salt River Studios in Cape Town is host me, Lydia Mahwanana. Broadcasting from WRHU Studios in Hempstead, New York, are your hosts, Cody Millar and Andy Gladding. We welcome you to join us for the next hour as we celebrate the power of community radio, music, language, and culture. The world is a big place, but using the power of radio, we're bringing it right to your door. Now Bush Radio and WRHU welcome you to the one world of community radio.
To the classics.
WRHU Hempstead, 89.5 Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, and 88.3 WRCT Pittsburgh. You're listening to the One World Radio Show on the One World Radio Network. I'm your host, Cody Millar, broadcasting from Pittsburgh. Joined with me from New York is Ricky Hubert, and from Cape Town, Lydia Marquana. Joining us today is Demi from Magical Hijinks. Demi, thank you so much for joining us today on the One World Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
How are y'all doing this beautiful morning and afternoon? Beauty of broadcasting in multiple time zones is we got a variety of weathers.
We're all right, Cody. How are you? How is everything? We're just saying, we're all in school zone. I'm a student, Cody's a teacher, so everybody's at like a different stage of the game in terms of the school year.
It's going all right, although it's a little cold at 13 degrees Fahrenheit right now, although it feels more like it's zero.
On my side, it is a super hot, like very, very hot. I couldn't even go outside the way it is so hot. We are on 30 degrees today. So yeah, it's blazing hot.
Well, I'm annoyed with the weather and I'm ready for it to not be so windy and cold. I don't mind the cold, but once you add these horrible winds we've been having, it's really just the tip of the iceberg for me. I'm done. I'm ready to leave the area for a few days.
Well, you get to leave the area quite a lot, Demi, with the work you do with Magical Hijinks. For those who don't know, tell us what you do, why we brought you on the show today with your work doing Magical Hijinks.
My YouTube channel and social media and business is Magical Hijinks. I am a theme park and travel YouTuber and content creator. And even though I am New York based, I travel down to Orlando mostly because that's where most people go down to vacation, the biggest destination for theme parks in the world. And every few weeks I head down there and I create videos in Walt Disney World, Universal, sometimes SeaWorld. And then I get to also go to other fun places too. Like this past year, I went to the opening of the brand new land called Fantasy Springs in Tokyo Disney Sea. I've done Disney cruises. I've gone to the California parks. And I love covering some smaller parks as well. And parks like Hershey and King's Dominion, Busch Gardens, any theme park you got, I'm happy to head over there. And I love being able to help people plan their trips and also bring people to the parks to escape a little in this world that we're in, that we could all use a little escape.
Now, Demi, when you're going on these trips to generate content, how long are you like in Orlando or other places for?
You know, it really depends on what's going on. So I typically go to Orlando. My schedule is usually based off of what's going on in the park. So, for example, in January, there was a mix of a couple of things. So I was there a little bit longer than maybe mostly in January, because in January we have Epcot's Festival of the Arts. So I usually base, you know, my time going down for around like the big events like that. And that's one of the most popular events that I cover. And then also this year was the opening of a brand new hotel for Universal Orlando called Stellanova Resort for the upcoming new theme park, Universal's Epic Universe, which opens May 22nd. So I was there from January 16th all the way to the 22nd. Because I had to wait for the opening. But then I had to go back down only a few weeks later to cover Mardi Gras in Universal Orlando. But for that, I was only there. I only needed to go for 2 nights because it wasn't that much to cover, you know, took a 1 to 2 day thing to cover. And then I go back down in March for Epcot's Flower and Garden Festival. But I usually stay around like 4 days. So it's because I'm not just covering those big events. I'm also making lots of other content and other videos. And basically what I do is I plan out my days and I create my content, make all my videos, and then I take them back home with me to New York and I edit them and I release them twice a week.
Demi, no, I don't think this is something where you wake up one morning and say, I'm going to do this. It's kind of something that you figure as you go along. What made you realize that this kind of work that you do with Magical Hijinks was something you had to explore for yourself?
You know, actually, it kind of was that. I work in theater in New York City. I've been working in professional theater since I'm 17 years old. And then back in 2020, when we shut down, I don't know if anyone was aware, but there was this thing called a global pandemic and we were stuck at home. And I wasn't a person that grew up going to the parks. I was raised by a single mom and we did our little regional parks, but you know, I always loved amusement parks and theme parks. So back in 2016, when I went with my boyfriend to Universal and Disney as just like a little vacation, I kind of started hyperfixating on the parks. So when I would be home, I would be watching videos or reading things all about all the parks and I'd get really excited about it. We went to Paris for our honeymoon in 2018, and we also got to go to Disneyland Paris. And then for my 25th birthday in December 2019, we went to Disney, and it was my first time going to not just Magic Kingdom, because that's all we did back in 2016, but that was my first time. I can't even believe it's so recent that my first time in Epcot, Hollywood Studios, and Animal Kingdom was in 2019 December. And I left that trip thinking, I need to figure out a way to come here more. I love this. I love this place. And then we shut down in March, and I had no idea what was going to happen for the future of theater, or the future, I guess, in general. And I started making like an Instagram first. You don't know what you're going to start. You just start something and you figure it out as you go. And I had an Instagram with a totally different name. And I was just kind of posting pictures of my trips to Disney and Universal, and just kind of starting out with that community. And then I decided, because we were home, I was going to start making cooking videos of Disney Parks food that you can make at home. I thought that was a little bit different than just like, you know, something else, but it's something that I could do. And at the time, I actually didn't even put myself on camera. I was never a person that was in front of a lot of people. I was a stage manager, still am on the side, but I was doing cooking videos of overhead cooking style. So I started that, and I realized like maybe 3 months into this, what am I doing? I hate cooking. I hate cooking. And then they announced the reopening of Walt Disney World and the reopening of Universal. And I kind of just looked at my husband and I said to him, I think I'm going to go. Literally, that's literally what I said. I just had this bug in me. And, you know, it was going to be my first time on camera, and you just kind of have to do it if you think you want to do it. And I knew like maybe this is something I could do. So I went to the reopening in, what was it, July of 2020, and I covered the reopenings of every parks. I got an annual pass before they actually, it was amazing because they stopped selling you annual passes. I got it just in time, and I covered the reopenings, and then I put out the videos and they were doing really well. And then I was posting on socials. And then in October, I rebranded to Magical Hijinks, because originally I was the Disney Kitchen because I was cooking, right? And after that, and you can still see all those old videos on the channel. They're still there. After that, it was like October. And I was like, you know, what if I went back down? I could do a little bit more. And yeah, that's kind of what happened. I just started going down more and more. And then I kind of started gearing the schedule toward the big events, like I said, to, you know, being down there. And I'll go for like, you know, 3 to 4 nights usually is like kind of what I roughly do. And I started making all the content. And now here we are almost, you know, 4.5 years later, almost 5 years, which is crazy to me. And 21,000 subscribers on YouTube and almost 70,000 followers on TikTok, and, you know, all on the socials as well. And I've built a really great community of people, and being able to not only help people, but to bring them joy, especially